Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board. In this show, we'll travel to a public library in North Carolina that loans out seeds for free as a way to help people grow their own heirloom fruits and vegetables.
We still want to play into the culture that's alive and well in Southern Appalachia, which is independence. And this is a way to tap into food independence.
And we talk with psychologist Carol Dweck on building resilience in ourselves and our neighbors. She compares the tradition of barn raising to emotional support we can offer each other to not lose hope.
Maybe if we know everyone was there for us, everyone supported each other, we could keep going.
And hunting is a big part of culture in Central Appalachia. Some even use primitive weapons like longbows and muzzleloader rifles.
There's a challenge to it. At some point, honestly, it's just pretty easy to kill an animal with a modern rifle. You know, you want to make it a little more challenging.
Stories of resilience, self-reliance, and survival in the mountains. That and more coming up this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board, guest hosting this week's show. Here in Central Appalachia, we have plenty of high-tech skills, and many of us can connect to orbiting satellites and therefore people and ideas on the other side of the globe in milliseconds. But there are a lot of isolated pockets throughout Appalachia where a smartphone is rendered pretty dumb. In place of that, though, you can find small farms beneath star-studded night skies where people still know how to raise much of their own food. Places where people visit each other's kitchens and front porches unannounced and are welcome. These are things that have never disappeared from the Appalachian landscape. Though these communities also face a lot of tough realities, too. But you have to wonder, these connections to the earth and each other go back hundreds of thousands of years. And might they just give us the tools we need to survive in years ahead? We're going to start today's show deep in the forests of West Virginia, where a group of hunters has been out in the new year using primitive weapons like recurve or longbows and flintlock muzzleloader rifles. West Virginia's mountaineer heritage hunting season began earlier this month, 2 weeks after most hunting seasons have closed. It's the second year since its conception. Our Folkways reporter Caitlin Tan spent time with hunters who still make vintage rifles, similar to the weapons many of our ancestors used hundreds of years ago.
Muzzleloader rifles are just like they sound. They are long guns, easily 4 feet. Hunters load black powder into the muzzle, the end of the gun, to fire. It takes an experienced person just under a minute to reload. That means for hunting, you typically have one shot to kill an animal.
Literally, these are not high-tech. These are primitive weapons. There's nothing high-tech about them.
That's Gene Watchering. As of last spring, he started making the West Virginia University Mountaineer rifle. His father, Marvin Watchering, made the rifle for over 40 years prior to that. Marvin made 949 muzzle loaders in his life, and Gene is on number 9. He says it takes him about 80 hours to make one rifle. Inside Gene's shop in Morgantown, there are 5 rifles mounted in front of a rugged cotton American flag. The rest of the shop is in a bit of disarray. Gene is still going through all of his father's tools, which he inherited. But the rifles on display stand out. He made them all this year.
A lot of frustrating hours in that gun. And I had to put it up for a little bit. And so I built this one. And that one is completely scraps out of his shop.
They all have a glossy wooden shine to them. 2 have a hand-carved gold emblem in the shape of West Virginia. Another is made out of bird's eye maple, which gives it a distinct patterned look. And there's a metal bear paw on the side. Gene says the knowledge of how to build muzzle loaders and even how to shoot them is dwindling. It's easier to hunt with modern rifles. They're easier to load, can shoot a longer range, and one can shoot multiple times within a matter of seconds. But he says black powder hunting is almost a sport of its own.
There's a challenge to it. At some point, honestly, it's just pretty easy to kill an animal with a modern rifle. It's just the reality of it. So, you know, you want to make it a little more challenging.
And that's a big reason the West Virginia Department of Natural Resources advocated for the Mountaineer Heritage hunting season. In a 2018 DNR survey of hunters, data showed that almost half of West Virginian hunters intended to take part in the season. And Gene is one of those people. He made his first muzzleloader at 11 years old, but up until a year ago, he mostly just hunted with them. He had stopped building the rifles in adulthood. But when Marvin passed away unexpectedly, Gene felt he didn't have a choice. WVU needed a new rifle right away, and Marvin had a list of other customers' orders dating back to 2010. Gene says as Marvin got older, he couldn't keep up with the rifle orders.
These are all the scribbled writings, and then you look at the printed out thing.
It's a stack of worn papers, big and small. Names and phone numbers are scribbled in every which direction.
There's 98, plus all the ones on the side, plus all the ones on the top. Yeah, he ran out of room. But some people are finding me.
For as long as Gene can remember, his dad was making muzzleloaders, so he says he didn't realize how special of a craft it is.
I've heard comments where my work's just as good as dad's. But when I look at it, I think it doesn't even match up. Completely different category.
Gene says he views carrying on the knowledge of making rifles as a responsibility, as there are few people in the state who are experts in the field these days. Larry Spizak is a West Virginian who also still builds muzzleloaders. His shop is down a windy turnpike outside Morgantown. It sits on several acres of forested land that he hunts on. Walking through the dead leaves, he finds a spot to shoot one of his handmade rifles. Larry prefers to make flintlock rifles, which is a type of muzzleloader. They're one of the oldest firearm technologies dating back to the 1500s. With a flintlock, one pulls the trigger and a piece of steel hits the flint, which is just a very hard rock. It creates a spark and ignites the black powder.
First thing I do is take my powder horn, and I've got my powder measure right here. And that's from a turkey leg bone.
All of Larry's supplies are handmade. A friend made the turkey powder measure, and Larry made the leather bag carrying his tools. He also made the rifle, and he even made the round lead ball, which serves as the bullet. Wrapped in a small piece of fabric, the ball goes into the barrel of the gun.
And what the patch does, it acts as a seal, and it also allows the rifling to grip the ball better and put that spin on the ball. All right, now we draw the ramrod and drive it home.
The ramrod pushes the black powder and bullet into the bottom of the gun, back by the flintlock.
Ready to fire. So, put on full cock. Here we go.
Larry also says the rifle is a large part of Appalachian history. Early settlers had to hunt for food, and muzzleloaders were the way they did it. And Larry says West Virginians today still embody their ancestors.
A large percentage of the population lives in the mountains, and maybe not realizing it, but they are in their everyday activities with farming, hunting. They are living a bit of the life that was commonplace and an everyday occurrence 200 years ago.
And that's why Larry still makes and hunts with muzzleloaders. He likes to feel connected to the settlers who paved the way for us in Appalachia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Morgantown.
The muzzleloader rifle is one of the emblematic symbols of the frontier image of the mountaineer. Yes, there are plenty of negative stereotypes that portray mountaineers as backwards, lawless, dirty, ignorant. But there's also a source of pride many people feel in what the mountaineer represents. Perhaps that's one reason it's also West Virginia University's mascot. A guy or a woman dresses in leather buckskin. At football games, they shoot a muzzleloader rifle into the air. It's one of the few mascots that doesn't wear a foam head. You can actually see the face of the mountaineer. Our Folkways reporter Caitlin Tan takes a closer look at what makes the mountaineer such an important symbol of the university and the state.
That's the sound of WVU fans cheering and the Mountaineer mascot's rifle firing. And a lot goes into that bang. There's 86 years of tradition. On a football game day, the Mountaineer stampedes down the field, rallying the crowd. The mascot wears a tan leather buckskin shirt and pants with long fringes that flap in the wind. There's a raccoon skin hat with a bushy tail and beady eyes, knee-high moccasins, and a bison horn that holds the black powder, the ammunition for that rifle. Among a cheering crowd of 60,000 fans and a stadium with a giant screen is a mountaineer who looks like he stepped straight out of the 1800s Appalachian frontier. Here's Timmy Eads. He's the current mountaineer.
Growing up in West Virginia, you're instilled with that that mountaineer pride at a very young age.
The mascot was officially recognized in the state in 1934. There are no top-tier pro sports teams in the state, so the vast majority of sport fans rally around the mountaineer. And this mascot doesn't look like a cartoon. It's a person, someone who can talk. Rosemary Hathaway is the author of the soon-to-be-released book Mountaineers Are Always Free. She says former mountaineers she interviewed all say it's more than a mascot for them.
Putting on the outfit and feeling, you know, just this almost magical kind of transformation that I'm both myself, but I'm also this sort of symbol of the state.
And becoming the mountaineer is a rigorous process. One has to be able to handle a gun, take a full class load, be a good public speaker, be willing to travel across the country, and have the energy to serve as a role model daily and be able to represent not only the university, but West Virginia as a whole. Gene Watring started making the Mountaineer rifle last year. His father, Marvin Watring, made rifles for the university for more than 40 years before he passed away in 2018. Gene says growing up, he watched many mountaineers come in and out of his father's shop.
They were you little kids dreaming about being a mountaineer. And, you know, they're here now, and they're growing through it. And I think they have to mature in the role because it's a big responsibility.
In just about 6 months, Timmy has attended over 250 events as the mountaineer. That's everything from elementary school visits to sports games to hospitals to rural hauler communities. He says he wears his buckskins almost every day. And one can tell. The leather has darkened, the creases look permanent, there's a musky smell. It's a little rough around the edges.
What I was told by former mountaineers to do, if you come home and you're absolutely drenched in sweat, or if it's starting to, you know, you're starting to catch an odor, just freeze it and freeze the entire thing. And what that does is the freezer will help kill the bacteria and helps it not smell so bad.
Each mountaineer keeps their buckskins at the end of their rein. Gary Nebel has been hand-stitching deer hides together to create the mountaineer outfit. He's been doing it since the 1980s. All of his work is in the style of pre-1840s.
We even make some of the buttons. We roll the buttons, leather buttons, or we'll put antler buttons on them.
Gary isn't from West Virginia, nor has he ever lived in the state. He lives in Indiana, but the university sought him out to make the outfit, and that's just how rare this skill set is. Gary says hand-making these buckskin outfits, much like our Appalachian ancestors did, is a knowledge that is also dwindling.
Well, when I'm gone, I don't know who'll take it over. I don't know whether my son will do it or not.
But he doesn't plan to retire anytime soon. Gene Watring, the new maker of the Mountaineer rifle, is someone who did take over his dad's business. His dad, Marvin, made 949 black powder rifles. Gene is on number 9. The Mountaineer uses a 45 caliber Kentucky long rifle, a weapon developed in the early 1700s. Gene says it's a primitive technology, and the pressure of making the WVU rifle is huge.
It's not just the Mountaineer. It's like all of Mountaineer Nation. If the rifle doesn't go boom, a lot of people are upset.
In a football game, the rifle is shot easily dozens of times, with a stadium and thousands of fans at home watching. The Mountaineer rifle Gene made this year is striking. It's a dark maple brown. It's about 4 feet long, and there's a gold metal hand-carved emblem in the shape of West Virginia on the side. Underneath, in gold metal, are the words, "Country roads, take me."
And I leave the state as the implied home. Like I said, I had to do maybe 5 of them to get the state and get the arc right and get the words to fit in there.
And on the other side is the distinctive flying WV. The letters almost look painted on.
I took coal and crushed it up and put it in a resin and then molded it in there. Yeah. Coal's just a big, it's part of West Virginia.
The WVU rifle is passed down each year to the new mountaineer. It's only replaced every 5 or 6 years. These days, the mountaineer typically has a big, bushy beard, although prior to the 70s, that wasn't the case. Rosemary Hathaway, the author of the upcoming Mountaineer book, says beards were seen as being unkempt and represented someone who has radical politics. In fact, the Mountaineer statue at WVU doesn't have a beard. And two women have been the Mountaineer, Natalie Tennant in 1990 and Rebecca Durst in 2009. Rosemary says the beard was used as an argument for not having a female as the mascot.
In their minds, I think, you know, you're not being sexist, right? Because you just can't grow a beard, so you can't be the Mountaineer. But I think it really was just kind of a cover for, you know, just sort of feeling like a woman shouldn't be the Mountaineer for a whole lot of other reasons. And not having a beard was just the easiest thing to point to.
And that brings up another point. In the 86 years since the mascot was officially recognized, there hasn't been a person of color in the role. Granted, over 75% of WVU's population is white, but there are certainly students of color. And only one person of color has ever applied. Rosemary says the women who were the Mountaineer faced a lot of backlash, and that could be intimidating for any minority student who is thinking of applying.
You know, I don't know what the reaction would be, whether people would be cool about it, or at least, you know, sort of feel like, well, it'd be politically incorrect for me to say something about that, so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut, or whether it would really, there would be just out and out kind of racist response to it.
The mascot application states that, quote, the Mountaineer Mascot Selection Committee and the Mountaineer Advisory Committee do not discriminate on the basis of race, sex, age, disability, veteran status, religion, sexual orientation, color, or national origin. Timmy Eads will pass the rifle that Gene made to the new Mountaineer this spring. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan in Morgantown.
Up next.
That's the biggest
what a
tomato.
Tomato.
The biggest tomato I've ever seen.
Oh my goodness.
Ever heard of oxheart tomato? Once thought to be lost, until heirloom seeds were rediscovered in an unlikely place. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Glynis Board, and we'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
In Appalachia, long traditions of seed saving made it possible for home gardeners to grow heirloom vegetable varieties that have been around for decades. Traditionally, growing these special seeds meant you had to have connections in the community. Seed saving and seed swaps were how people found new seeds. Today, though, there are organizations like seed libraries and community gardens that help save these seeds from being lost. One of our Folkways Core reporters, Rachel Green, spent some time in Ashe County, North Carolina, talking to the people who are helping give old seeds a new life.
When Travis Birdsell visited the barn of an Ashe County farmer in 2017, he had no idea what he'd find.
The upper levels of the barn were being picked, and they found seeds smeared on an old grocery store paper sack, and all the words said were Big Red.
Big Red ended up being an oxheart tomato, an heirloom variety that's famous for its huge size. You can't miss it. Each tomato clocks in at 2 to 2.5 pounds. That's more than 4 times the size of an average tomato in the grocery store. There are only a few tomatoes on each vine, surrounded by wispy leaves. Birdsell, who's the Ashe County Cooperative Extension Director, decided to plant the oxheart seeds. He didn't know what to expect. No one knew how long the tomato seeds had been there.
There was only one seed that germinated from what we found in the top of that barn.
Now, the oxheart is a staple in the Ashe County Victory Garden. Birdsell started the garden in 2016 to preserve and reintroduce heirloom vegetable varieties in southern Appalachia, and he says the heirlooms, like the oxheart tomato, have a flavor, shape, and even color that's unique. There's literally no other tomato like it. When Birdsell told me about the tomato, I knew I had to try it. Even late in the growing season, most of the tomatoes were still green, but I managed to find one that was fully ripe. I knew I wouldn't be able to eat it all by myself, so I enlisted my mom and little sisters to help.
That's the biggest
what a tomato.
Tomato. The biggest tomato I've ever seen.
Oh my goodness.
I wonder how it tastes.
How much does it weigh?
The tomato was impressive. It was enormous, of course, and also a vibrant red. There were just a few seeds, mostly around the outer edges. Otherwise, the inside was firm and meaty, just like Birdsell described.
Mmm.
The flavor is incredibly rich and robust. Now, I don't like to admit it, but I don't normally go for a tomato unless it's something really special. And I was worried this one might be tough, since it doesn't have many seeds. But it's tender and juicy and slightly sweet. This is a good tomato for everyone that doesn't think they like tomatoes. Varieties like the Oxheart tomato are kept alive thanks to the work of seed savers. And here in Ashe County and throughout Appalachia, the work they do is crucial in keeping heirloom varieties on our tables and in our bellies. Birdsell hopes to use the Victory Garden to highlight that.
We still want to play into the culture that's alive and well in southern Appalachia, which is independence. And this is a way to tap into food independence.
Getting seeds into the hands of home gardeners is a key part of that self-sufficiency. This year, Birdsell hopes to produce enough of the Oxheart tomatoes to make seeds available to the public next year through the Ashe County Seed Library, which is about a mile up the road in West Jefferson, North Carolina.
So our seed library is located in an old card catalog.
This is Lee Payne, a reference librarian at the Ashe County Public Library.
And so the way that it's organized in the drawers are alphabetical by seed type.
When I visit the seed library, the drawers are stuffed with dozens of varieties of seeds. There are beans, an Ashe County staple, and also tomatoes, greens, and even flowers. Each tiny manila envelope contains about a dozen seeds. All the seeds at the Ashe County Seed Library are free. You don't even need a library card.
We do want to make things available, and so if you want to try a new variety of corn, if we have it, take it. It's yours.
And when the cost of heirloom seeds can sometimes be more than $4 in stores, it can seem like a radical idea to give them away, says Birdsell.
Being able to provide for yourself is liberating, and being able to have access to free seeds is the start of that process.
And some of these seeds have been saved generation after generation by local families. That's Vida Blevins' story. Her brother donated a special variety of pole bean that's been a staple in their family since the 1920s. I visit Blevins and her mom, Kata Owen McNeil, at their townhouse in Jefferson. It's on a hill that overlooks Main Street, less than a quarter mile from the Victory Garden. The space is cozy. Family portraits and paintings line the walls. Blevins doesn't grow a garden now. That's her brother's hobby. But she does appreciate that he shares the bounty from his garden year after year. And now that the family's pole bean is available in the seed library, anyone in the community is able to try it.
And they are a flat bean, kind of like a Kentucky Wonder.
She called it the six-week bean.
And they will produce in 6 weeks from the day they were planted.
Blevins remembers her family liked to grow the bean because they could have up to 2 harvests a year, more than a traditional green bean. She and her brother learned to save seeds from their parents. Their mom, McNeil, has lived in Ashe County for a century.
I was born in Crumper, North Carolina in 1919.
McNeil was the 7th child of 12. She grew up on a family farm just a few miles north of Jefferson. They grew and preserved most of the food they ate. She remembers giant 65-gallon barrels of sauerkraut that her family would make and share with their neighbors. And to save money, they spent many hours at the end of each season saving seeds.
So we wouldn't have to buy them.
McNeil grew up during the Great Depression. Then, seed saving was a necessity. This was before vegetable varieties were domesticated like they are today. They saved seeds from apples, cabbage, and parsnips. Her dad even built a small room specifically for drying pumpkin and apple seeds. She taught her daughter to save seeds, too.
I can just see the tomato seeds on the cloths lying in the window.
Blevins is describing a process called dry processing. You let the seeds dry in the sun.
But I think it's kind of a lost art now.
Seed saving may be less common than it was a few decades ago, but it can still have the power to shape entire communities, says Sarah Harrison, who donated seeds to the Ashconee Seed Library.
Seeds are so important. We don't really think about it that much, but the fact of the matter is one simple seed can produce a whole plant, which can produce hundreds of more seeds, which can feed a whole community.
And the cost of losing these seeds could be devastating for Appalachian communities down the road, says Chris Smith, the executive director of the Utopian Seed Project, based in Asheville, North Carolina.
It's really sad. We've seen such a narrowing of available varieties, and that means a narrowing of available genetics.
Smith says that seed saving helps build ecological resilience, because if we only have a handful of different types of tomatoes or types of beans, we aren't as adaptable as we would be if we have hundreds of different types of heirloom seeds kept somewhere safe. As a researcher, he says that genetic diversity in seeds is key for a sustainable, resilient future.
If we're saving our own seeds in our own regions, then what we see is crop adaptability from season to season.
And the seeds that have grown here, in this climate, for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years, are simply better adapted to southern Appalachia than most of the seeds you can buy in the store. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Rachel Green in Ashe County, North Carolina.
Of course, there are other seed libraries across Appalachia and the world. There's even a seed vault located deep inside a glacial mountain in Norway, which currently can hold over 4 million varieties of seeds. It's a long-term seed storage facility built to stand the test of time and the challenge of natural or man-made disasters. Low temperatures and moisture levels there ensure low metabolic activity, keeping the seeds viable for decades, centuries, maybe even thousands of years. Of course, the permafrost is meant to keep the seeds safe, even if electricity fails. However, we're discovering that a warming climate means the vault is not as fail-safe as we hoped. Just one more reason to make sure we are keeping our own local heirloom seeds safe and planting them year after year.
You can walk to the other side of this town. You can drive to the border of the sea. This place has everything.
Resourcefulness, self-reliance. Many people who live in the mountains cherish and self-identify with these values. But could we sustain ourselves, really? As part of an occasional series, Wild Wandering West Virginia, Lana Lester of Wyoming County submitted her question to the Inside Appalachia team. Could West Virginia be self-sustaining? She said she's always had the feeling that God blessed West Virginia with all of our natural resources and that we have everything there in the state to survive. Well, Lana, our listeners voted, and your question won the latest round. So, could we survive on our own? And what would that really look like? Roxy Todd set out to try to find some answers.
I began the search outside Keller Survival Shop, which is located in Kanawha County in a suburb of Charleston, West Virginia. I'm greeted by a herd of miniature goats.
Brownie, get down.
Bob Keller, the owner of this shop, is wearing a forest green fleece and khaki pants. He says these goats are mostly pets, but if needed, they could provide his family with goat milk.
They're the smallest, but they have the highest butter fat content of any of the dairy goats. They breed, they give birth, they produce milk. And as long as you continue to milk them, they'll continue to produce milk.
Goats can also provide meat. Raising goats is just one way people with a small plot of land could be more self-sufficient, Keller says.
People really don't realize, you know, if you took a, you know, even a 10 by 20 spot in the yard at home, how much food that spot would create.
We're inside his survivalist shop now, where he sells dried food that has a long shelf life and water purification materials.
There are people that are, I would say, that I know locally that are in the 90-some percent self-reliant.
Some of these people Keller knows might be called doomsday preppers, a subgenre of folks who prepare their home to be able to survive on their own in case of a catastrophic event. But Keller says he sees all ranges of people in his store who are interested in learning to survive without having to go to the store.
My business in general is going up rapidly.
Beyond his own business, he sees other signs that more people seem to have an interest in self-reliance.
I mean, even our elementary schools are putting in gardens, right, to teach kids where food comes from. Because the kids don't know where food comes from.
This lack of knowledge and skills make people pretty vulnerable compared to our grandparents or great-grandparents, Keller says. Things like canning, growing food, carpentry, basic mechanics. There is a lot that our West Virginia ancestors understood that we lost.
I think it's a product of 21st century America. We were sold this approach growing up that, well, if there's a problem, go buy the solution.
But Keller says he thinks people in West Virginia have retained a lot of these skills and knowledge.
You go to rural areas, and those self-sustaining skills and activities are still alive and well. And so when you look at less densely populated states, you have a lot of this activity going on.
But it's not only West Virginians who are interested in learning to be more self-reliant. A survey commissioned by the economic analysis website Finder.com found that in 2018, one in four American adults spent up to $2,000 on home renovations to prepare for emergencies. Millennials actually spent the most on survivalist gear. But does that mean that younger people are more prepared, or are they just shopping as a way to compensate for a lack of hands-on know-how?
Now we have Amazon that can deliver things in a day. So are our children going to be more prepared or less prepared, do you think?
You're seeing a split. You're seeing some people who are raising their children to be self-reliant, and you're seeing some people who aren't self-reliant themselves. Of course, they're not raising their children that way.
But what would it really mean to be self-sustaining? Not just individually, but as a state. Like, what if West Virginia broke away from the rest of the country? Or what if a natural or geopolitical disaster suddenly forced us to make it entirely on our own, cut away from the rest of the country or the world? No importing, no exporting, producing everything ourselves. I sent her question over to economist John Deskins at West Virginia University to get his take.
What was going through my mind, to be honest, I was thinking, ooh, this is a bad idea. if you want my honest opinion.
On a personal level, Deskin says he gets why this might be appealing.
But if you want to harvest a deer from your backyard, or if you want to grow your own tomatoes and cucumbers in your backyard, you may be able to do that better than the ones we import from California or wherever. I'd much rather get a backyard tomato than one from the grocery myself. But the people are free to do that.
As an economist, Deskins thinks it would be disastrous if we force people to buy things that are made locally. Trade is just more efficient, he says, than producing everything ourselves.
You know, if everyone's just going it alone, then you don't really have the opportunity to be really good at something and to capitalize upon your kind of special talent.
Currently, West Virginia is pretty self-sufficient when it comes to our electricity. About 92% comes from coal that we mine right here in the state. Of course, the grid we pull from is a regional grid, so it's possible the electrons you're using right now were not produced by coal. And setting up a new grid that is independent of the rest of the country would take a lot of time and work. But it's possible. It's a long-term goal, if we continue to mine coal. Apart from our electricity, though, West Virginia is not so poised to be self-sufficient. We import roughly $3.4 million worth of goods from out of the country. Mechanical products are at the top of the list. Incidentally, a lot of our imports include airplane parts, so we could likely do without those if we were just trying to survive on our own. But when it comes to what we would eat, well, the picture is a lot more bleak. Despite Bob Keller's optimism that we could grow a lot of our own food in a 10 by 20 plot in our yard, plus some milk-producing goats, currently, West Virginians produce just 1/7 what we consume when it comes to food. So we need to support and incentivize farming. And we'd have to do without a lot of foods that just don't grow well here, like lemons and chocolate and coffee. Not to mention a lot of other things that use raw materials that we just don't have in West Virginia, like cell phones or EKG machines. And doing without these things, argues economist John Deskins, means we'd have a lower quality of life.
Well, I'm saying you have two extremes. One extreme is where individual households are self-sufficient, right? That is an extreme system. That's like a caveman-type system. And then the other end of the stream is a purely global economy where we have specialization across the entire world. We have a huge amount of specialization and trade on a grand scheme.
In the middle of these two extremes, though, Deskin says he could imagine a world where we're still importing and exporting some things, but still producing more stuff and growing more food in state.
It's better than no specialization at all, but it's not fully capitalizing upon the high level of specialization that we have in a global economy.
Even as a champion of an economic free market, Deskins admits there would be some benefits to being more self-sustaining.
If we were self-sufficient and if we just bought from other parts of West Virginia, it would greatly reduce the transportation cost. It would reduce the fuel, other expenses associated with moving goods, and there might be some environmental benefit associated with that.
It would also be easier to keep a closer eye on health and safety standards. Still, bottom line, if we want our economy to be strong, global trade is essential. But here's something economists like Deskins don't measure when they talk about quality of life. I don't know about you, but I like to buy and use things when I know the person who made it. I would personally pay more money for a chair made by my neighbor than one I buy online that comes from China. Same with my food. I like the idea of learning to grow my own corn and taking it to my neighbor to grind it into cornmeal. Maybe even learning to survive with less.
You know, I see a West Virginia that really uses nature as a driver of economic growth.
This is Beth Wheatley, director of the West Virginia Nature Conservancy. We're standing atop a ridgeline in Mingo County. In every direction are mountains. Some are thick with forests. Others are stripped to rubble and rock.
Mountains over here to our east. The leaves have fallen off of the trees. Over here, we're looking at a flat landscape, but still completely surrounded by forest on most sides. And this is very typical of many sites in West Virginia where you have former coal mine lands surrounded by intact forest.
Wheatley's brought me here to see this view because she says it shows two radically different types of landscapes. Both are abundant here in central Appalachia, and both have potential to help people in West Virginia be more self-sufficient, says Wheatley.
There is so much that we can produce ourselves.
And the self-reliance doesn't necessarily have to come from manufacturing or coal. She and others at the Nature Conservancy are working to find more ways that forested land can earn West Virginians money. As for all the acres of land that have previously been strip mined, Wheatley says she envisions a future where solar farms are producing energy.
It's virtually the perfect site for solar development because it's relatively flat, because of transmission lines and access. We have the sun at our disposal. We have hundreds of thousands of former mine lands at our disposal, and many owners of those lands very interested in solar development.
Several years ago, the Nature Conservancy conducted a listening project across West Virginia. In addition to economic opportunities, many people told Wheatley they value living amidst so much nature.
And I remember one person saying that, you know, that she doesn't see it as something separate from us, but it's part of who West Virginians are. It's in our blood. And that really gives us the grit and determination and connection to the land to really work together to grow nature-friendly economic development activities in the state going into the future. I think we can have it all.
And some people are making a go at having it all.
They built a life that was all their own.
That's beautiful, Pat.
They found peace.
Not bad.
Pretty good.
Absolutely beautiful.
In the stunning beauty of the wilderness.
This is from a trailer to a film from the 70s called The Wilderness Family.
Now they will be tested in ways they never imagined.
It's a story of a family who escaped the traffic and city life of Los Angeles to build a cabin and settle in the wilderness. Ed Klein says this film inspired him to move his family to West Virginia and live off the land. They were in Brooklyn at the time.
Believe it or not, when they moved here, they lived in a tent. There was no houses up here. It was all brush and growed up. They lived in a tent.
This is Klein's new wife, Dana. His first wife left, as did his kids. But Klein stayed. From that first year in 1978, living in a tent, today he has an enormous three-story cabin that he designed and built himself, back in the rugged hills of Wetzel County. He has his own wood shop and a greenhouse, though neither are being used much these days.
Do you have any regrets for this life you built out here?
No, not at all. I just regret this.
Klein has some health issues now, so it's a little tough to hear him. If he didn't catch it, he said, how could you regret this?
Do you think more people could do this type of life, or do you feel like you're unique?
If you want to do this, go buy a piece of land. If you're really serious, I'll help you. Okay. It's a blessing.
With a small plot of land, Klein says anyone could do this. But you'll need help, people who can teach you the skills you'll need to survive. He also said if I'm serious, he'd help, but he'd need a letter from my psychiatrist. Though, I'm not sure if he means only someone with some level of mental illness would try to live off the land, as he has done, or if it takes someone who is taking care of their mental health. Later, as I reflect more on this, I decide maybe he means both. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
One story is probably not going to answer such a big question. What do you think? Could West Virginia be self-sustaining? What would that look like? What's your vision? We'd love to keep this conversation going. Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or tweet us at @inappalachia. Today, we're exploring stories about survival and resilience because we mountaineers are resourceful and proud of our ability to make do, often with less. But all this talk about the future can be overwhelming, especially if someone is struggling just to keep their head above water on a personal level, pay their bills, and juggle all the day-to-day responsibilities of family and work. For some insight into how we can find more resilience in our own lives, we're going to check in with psychologist Carol Dweck. She's the author of Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. Jessica Lilly recently sat down to speak with Dweck about how we as humans think about our own talents and abilities and how these mindsets can dramatically influence our lives.
Dr. Dweck, thanks for joining me.
A pleasure.
So what is it that you do? How would you explain your expertise and your work with Stanford, as well as authoring this book?
My research is on people's beliefs and how these beliefs can be so powerful in shaping their lives. For example, one thing I've looked at extensively is whether people believe their basic qualities, their intelligence, talents, and abilities
are just fixed. You have a certain amount and that's it. Or whether these are abilities that can be developed throughout life, not just by your personal effort and strategies, but also by the help, support, input, teaching from others. Now, we find that when people endorse mostly a fixed mindset, events can be devastating. They can be undermining. They can lead you to give up. You can think, my abilities have been tested. When you're in more of a growth mindset, things can still be pretty devastating, but you feel, okay, I'm on a path. There's more to me than I have found so far, and I'm going to use everything I can to grow, make more of myself, and help not just myself, but those around me to thrive.
It seems that the growth mindset is a way of sort of capturing or cultivating hope.
Yes, I think that's very insightful. I think a growth mindset doesn't guarantee that you'll become brilliant or that your life will be wonderful, but it does keep you on the path to becoming more, to seeking more, to growing. You don't feel like life is over, life is not for me, I'm disappointed in what life has to offer. You keep thinking there's more and there are things I can do and things we can do collectively to have a better future.
When does exhaustion come into play? I would say, you know, if you have this constant effort and mindset of believing that things are going to get better and believing that you can overcome these huge challenges, and then personally you see very little change with this, what's your concern or thoughts about that? And I say it really quickly because here in West Virginia we often have this very proud persona, or we're very proud of the fact that we are tough and strong and we can overcome all these things. But then, you know, how do we eventually, it becomes exhausting.
That's why we say it's not just about effort, because also that even putting in the effort and strategies, doing everything, it doesn't ensure an outcome. And that's why I think it's so important to create and maintain a sense of community, because I believe deeply that a solid interdependent community can achieve things that individuals can't. I'm thinking back to the old practice of barn raising, very popular on American farms in the past. No one farmer could really afford to build a barn. And yet barns were absolutely essential for storage, for animals in the winter, for the survival of the farm. So what could they do? The whole community would get together to raise a barn for a given farmer. In the end, every farmer had a barn. Everyone had something that they could not do themselves. Everyone had it because everyone participated. And so in these crises, of course individuals get exhausted. Of course they feel often that their efforts have not been rewarded. But maybe we don't all get exhausted at the same time. Maybe the people who still have some energy can pitch in and keep us going. Maybe if we know everyone was there for us, everyone supported each other, we could keep going. I think a lot of the opioid epidemic is about people giving up on themselves and their lives and not feeling anyone is there for them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dweck. I really appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
That conversation with Dr. Carol Dweck got me thinking about this buzzword, resilience. The word can evoke romantic notions of determination and grit, but like Jessica alluded to in the last interview, resilience often isn't fun or glamorous at all, but sometimes it can be simple. I recently heard about some research that examined how the places we live shape our ability to build stronger communities. Here's a clip from a psychology professor at West Virginia University named James Noland, who used to be a cop.
We've done a study recently in West Virginia. We had a West Virginia phone survey that we've conducted over a two-year period where we asked people about their community and the relationships they have with each other and the police. And we find that in places where people know each other, there's some level of cohesion, there's a willingness to intervene for the common good. In these types of places, there's low risk of crime. There's low risk of violence. There's low risk of guns being listed as a problem, and drugs also. But in places where there's conflict or alienation in the communities, in West Virginia, these places predict almost 100%, it's in the 90-some percent, that drugs are going to be a problem, and guns are going to be a problem, and crime is going to be a problem. And then there's a third type of place that people are not connected to each other. They don't know their neighbors, but they feel safe because they believe that the police can protect them. These places are also not very safe. So it's a dependence on the government, dependence on the police, dependent on the authority to protect the community, to shortcut the interactions that are necessary to make a community really strong, that work against safety.
I think the thing that's powerful about this clip is kind of how obvious it seems. I mean, the more alienated we become from one another, the more fear we have about the unknown. And while it is impressive how many people manage to power through tough times and come out stronger on the other end, should we really depend on our own rugged individualism? In today's show, we heard about this idea of the image of the mountaineer, a symbol of how strong and resilient we mountaineer people can be. But mountaineers are also known for helping friends and neighbors. And I think true resilience is not found in how strong the individual is, but how strong our communities are. And we aren't powerless. We can change things. But the key word here is we. It only works if we start by leaning on each other and working toward common goals. So, till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by John R. Miller, Dinosaur Burps, and Spencer Elliott. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Kara Lofton helped edit our show this week. Our mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.